Hi, I'm Jane McCallion.
And I'm Adam Shepherd.
And you're listening to the IT Pro podcast. The tech skills gap has been a focus of discussion and concern, both in the industry and often at a national level, for at least a decade now. Evidence such as tens of thousands of unfilled job roles is provided, and we talk about the need to boost the number of people studying computer science in order to bolster the economy.
But what if this evidence is the equivalent of blurry photos of Bigfoot and vague footprints in the snow? This week, we're asking if the tech skills gap is a real thing or merely the product of overactive imaginations.
So I think that a good place for us to start before we get into whether or not the tech skills gap exists is to define what it means.
So the tech skills gap, generally speaking, is referred to as a lack of skilled candidates to fill the open tech roles within the broader business community. So that includes things like systems engineers, software developers, network specialists, etc., etc.
So it's a lack of talent rather than necessarily a lack of knowledge, if you like, or I guess kind of both.
the two kind of go hand in hand. It's generally seen as a lack of people with the relevant skills to fill the job roles that are needed in today's business world. So some of the most common areas that this crops up in is in things like cloud computing, containers and Kubernetes. Security is another big one.
Data science.
Is constantly, data science, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it both is and isn't a new thing. It's not something that cropped up sort of last week or last year. It's been talked about since at least 2015, but it's probably a little bit older than that. And really, it's something that seems to be accelerating. Every time that I see a study or something comes into my inbox, the number of people, or rather the number of unfilled job roles, seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's like 50% bigger every time that I see the figure.
So there's been a number of surveys and studies done on this. Last year, a global survey by Harvey Nash and KPMG found that an all-time high of 67% of companies are looking at a shortage of tech skills within their businesses.
So I'm such a nerd when it comes to statistics. But that number, so a 67% high of companies facing a tech skills gap, that could be like hundreds of roles unfilled in a single company, or it could be one in thousands of companies.
Technically, yes. But I think with this, nobody's going to report, because this is based on a survey, so nobody's going to report that they're facing a tech skills gap if they've got like two vacancies.
I suppose it depends on how long those vacancies have been open.
I suppose, and the seniority of those roles that are still unfilled.
Yeah.
But it is certainly a problem that is continually identified by the sector. For example, Engineering UK has reported that open vacancies in the engineering sector grew by 14%. Over the last year, with an estimated shortfall of between 37,000 and 59,000 for core engineering roles requiring level 3 plus skills.
That's a huge number, really. So what's driving this?
So what's driving this is predominantly, according to Engineering UK, a strong competition for skilled candidates combined with a shortage of applicants with the appropriate qualifications. There's also a lack of young people coming through the education pipeline with those relevant skills.
That really surprises me. And I don't know whether it's just because I, you know, sit in this bubble of tech, but there's such an emphasis on the importance of tech skills and how this is a great job pathway. And we spoke previously to Jess Craig of Twilio, you know, who's moved from one career pathway and into programming. It really surprises I think you can probably tell by the way that I keep repeating, it really surprises me that this really surprises me.
Well, I think part of the problem is that there is still a very strong perception that tech and IT is something that you need to be very analytical and very kind of mathematically inclined to pursue, and that you need to have a really strong grasp of science and math, and that coding is something that takes years and years to learn to a kind of a good standard, which is, as we've previously discussed, absolutely not the case. There are tons of free tools that enable you to pick up kind of basic entry-level coding skills really quite quickly. But there is still this perception that it's really kind of quite high-minded and quite difficult to break into.
I mean, that's all very well for us to talk about as adults. But, for children and teenagers who are, unfortunately, the age of sort of 16, 17, maybe even kind of 18, trying to decide what they want to do for the whole of the rest of their life, the idea of kind of transferring from one area to another, it's not really applicable. And do you not, in order to get onto computing degree programs, for example, need to have decent maths and science background, and probably English as well? Is the problem not that actually for people entering the workforce, or building up their skills to enter the workforce, you do need all that? And and then the other point of that is possibly that the parents of children and young people who are kind of looking to where they're going to go with their life, you are of an age where actually you really did need those skills. They were a prerequisite to do anything to do with coding, because there was less sort of natural language coding back then.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it. There is still a big kind of perception problem. And, let's not forget, coding has been on the national curriculum for a number of years now. But there's still, I think, quite an entrenched view within society at large that coding is for kind of mathsy people, and that it's a very kind of specific skill set that you need to be a programmer or an IT person, which is just not the case anymore. But before we get too deep into the topic of STEM education, which I'm sure we'll talk about in later episodes, I think it's worth bringing it back to the workplace side of things, and the impact that this, supposed tech skills gap can have on businesses, because the supposed skills gap has been blamed for things like projects not being completed in time, things like security breaches, things like, increased levels of burnout and stress from teams having to pick up really too much workload.
Yeah, and as with sort of, I guess, any department that is overloaded with work, that's going to have a detrimental effect for the people who are working within that division, for that division within the business, and for the business as a whole. And ultimately, you're going to have to find a way of resolving it.
And another thing to bear in mind is that tech has been exploding over the last, over the last decade, really. Companies are continually expanding the size of their software development teams. They're investing in, new technologies like cloud computing, or potentially more cutting edge things like AI and blockchain. They're modernizing their network infrastructure. All of these kind of initiatives, which all require, new teams, bigger teams, teams with specific skills that maybe their existing staff didn't necessarily have, all of that comes at a cost.
So what is being done to try and resolve it? Obviously, once again, without getting too far into the STEM stuff, coding is on the curriculum. Perhaps it should be held in the same high regard as English, maths and science. And also, there is an encouragement of, sort of, are you disaffected in your current job? Then why not try coding, kind of thing. So, I mean, what else is being done to try and solve it?
Well, there's a number of initiatives and practices that are being deployed both by the business community and by industry groups and governments. So one thing that has picked up a lot of traction in recent years is upskilling and cross-skilling, taking people from other departments or other verticals within your business and bringing them into the IT function, training them up, giving them any support that they need in order to gain those skills that you're looking for, and moving people across into the IT function without having to hire externally.
So it's interesting, though, this idea of like cross-skilling and who's good at what. One of my old French lecturers at university started out her career in IBM.
Oh, wow.
So she graduated from a French degree, and they believed at that time, so at a guess I'd say the 70s, that linguists were best placed to be programmers because they understood the importance of syntax, of word, or that kind of thing. And a lot of coding is quite closely related to, I guess, it's more like algebra, which is actually more like natural language than it is maths. That kind of didn't work out, but it's interesting that now it's all kind of like, hello, you're from a humanities background. Have you thought about programming a computer? We thought about this once before, and well, we'd like to try it again.
Well, you say that people with a humanities background are in fact quite well suited to working on software development in particular, because they are, generally speaking, well placed to look at creative problem solving and thinking about things in ways that people with more analytical brains and thought patterns don't necessarily. So ideally, what you want within a software development team is, you know, some people who are very mathematic and analytical, but also backed up by people with you know, experience in things like English or art or philosophy to tackle things like creative problem solving. And, you know, lest we forget, things like AI ethics, which, you know, people with philosophy and humanities backgrounds are much better placed to think about than someone with, say, a maths degree.
We're going to take a short ad break now, but when we get back, we'll be looking at why the tech skills gap might be a different problem altogether.
See you after the break.
Welcome back. So before the break, we talked about the evidence for the skills gap, but let's look at the evidence against it, because it's not certain that this is actually a thing that even really exists, is it?
No. So there's a number of factors, actually, which suggest that the quote-unquote skills gap may not be as cut and dried as simply being a case of not having enough people to fill the roles. In actual fact, there may be enough talented people to fill all the roles that, you know, that need to be filled, but it's just that the recruitment process has problems, let's
say. So there was a famous case of IBM basically wanting their candidates to have invented time travel. They wanted 12 years experience in Kubernetes, which is only 6 years old.
Yeah, and that's far from an outlier as well. There are numerous reports of job ads having similarly unfeasible requirements. For example, Sebastian Ramirez, who created the Fast API, reported seeing a job posting that wanted 4+ years of experience with Fast API, which he only invented a year and a half ago. You know, similarly, a researcher reported, and this was back in 2012, interviewing a 28-year-old designer who said he had 17 years experience designing websites, which for anyone keeping track at home would actually put him before the development of the World Wide Web.
So from the point of view of companies wanting experience that, you know, is possible to have if you believe in linear time, is this a problem of, like, say, the HR department, you know, the recruiters themselves, or where, you know, where is this coming from?
A large part of it is that HR departments are drawing up job specs for roles that they don't necessarily know anything about. So they will be given a kind of very brief thumbnail sketch overview of what requirements the actual, you know, business unit needs. So, you know, things like Kubernetes or fast API experience, but will kind of have pretty much free rein to set the specific requirement levels. Of course, there's also another side of it, which is that there's sometimes accusations that these job roles are made deliberately unfeasible in order to discourage external applicants and favour internal applicants and people who have been kind of given the nod and the wink inside the business, but for, you know, whatever reason, still need to put the role out for public tender, as it were.
Yeah, so I know that some organisations, that's basically their policy, is that all jobs have to be advertised publicly, because, you know, I've seen things where, you know, kind of you've got the job spec and at the bottom it says this role is closed to external applicants, or this role is only for you know, people who are already employed with us. I'm like, what the hell is it doing on your career site? Why is it here? Why can I see it? You know, all that kind of thing. It's a bit nuts, and it's not really helpful for anyone, is it?
No, it's not at all. And the interview process and the recruitment process has a number of other problems that can skew the perception of how many talented applicants are actually out there. For example, there was a study done by NC State which demonstrated that technical interviews for tech roles, i.e. when you're in an interview situation and have to, you know, solve a particular programming problem or demonstrate what code you would write to perform a specific function, that kind of thing, those kinds of interviews actually don't really test the applicant's programming talents or tech skills. What they actually test is how comfortable are you at public speaking, how comfortable are you at getting up in front of, you know, three or four strangers and, you know, doing your working out on a whiteboard while they watch. And for, you know, anyone with, you know, social anxiety or anyone who maybe isn't super comfortable with public speaking, which, you know, is quite a lot of developers and software engineers, particularly those with kind of maybe more analytical backgrounds, as we talked about before the break, that can be quite challenging. And it means that those kinds of people who in actual fact are perfectly suited to those roles seem like they're not as talented as the people that can do that kind of public speaking very easily.
So what I'm hearing here is that I am the ideal candidate for this because I don't have the requisite experience, but that doesn't matter because nobody does, because, you know, what they're asking for is impossible. And I'm actually quite good at public speaking and presenting. So, well, it's been nice to know you all. I'm off to leave journalism and going to be a programmer with all the experience that they need, all the skills that they need for me to get the job anyway. Jane McCallion out.
But no, this is, you know, this is something that has been identified as a problem. Similarly, pair programming is something that is used quite a lot as part of the recruitment process for technical roles. And it's something that is not looked upon super favorably as part of that. Of course, pair programming can be very useful, you know, when you're already in a role for kind of developing your skills and for, you know, learning new things and getting outside of your comfort zone. But in an interview setting, it can be quite daunting, I think, for applicants.
And yeah, we're only looking at one end of this. Not only is bringing people into the profession perhaps a little bit of a problem, whether that is there just aren't enough people, or entry roles just don't make any sense. Once people are inside the tech industry, there is a real problem of burnout and retention. It's something that comes up frequently with women in tech. There is also a problem specifically in the security industry as well, which we ran a feature on back in 2020. So yeah, it's a multi-layered issue as well. And once again, kind of this idea of there being a skills gap. Well, there are plenty of people out there with the skills. It's just they've been broken by the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is a chicken and egg thing, as we discussed in the first part. When companies have a lot of open technical roles, it means the existing IT staff end up having to pick up a lot more slack and have to take on a lot more responsibility in order to cover those gaps, which leads to, as you mentioned, more burnout, and it leads to, less people overall in a kind of vicious cycle. But yeah, the problem of people dropping out of the industry is still a really quite bad one. And in fact, those same kind of problems of long work hours and, mental health problems within the industry can put some people off even getting into it to begin with.
And there's always the idea, like you said, kind of these long workouts, that kind of Silicon Valley startup type mentality that persists for much longer than it should. Running a startup is not the same as running a mature business, and you shouldn't have to be sleeping under your desk and putting in, sort of 12-hour days or whatever if your company is functioning properly, if it is a healthy company. Mm-hmm. While I appreciate the part of the problem we're talking about here is that there aren't enough people to fill the roles, so people are having to work overtime, perhaps being a bit more flexible with what you will accept down at the bottom end would resolve a lot of these pressures and mean that there are fewer job vacancies.
Mm. And on the subject of startups, I think that the startup culture more broadly does have quite a big role in this as well, particularly when it comes to pay and compensation, because there are a lot of startups and even kind of maturer companies who still view themselves through a startup lens that aren't willing to pay fair market rates for the roles that they want. There are a lot of companies who seem to be under the impression that, the equity, for example, and a solid benefit system and things like, a ping pong table or free beer on Fridays is enough to make up for, paying under the odds for the salaries for technical roles. And, it's kind of not necessarily a huge surprise that companies who aren't willing to pay fair market rates for technical roles are struggling to fill those roles.
And that's an interesting one, because one of the promises of choosing a career in IT is supposed to be that it's well paying. But if part of the problem with the tech skills gap is actually low pay, then like you said, once again, I think the problem actually with the idea of the tech skills gap is the word skills, because the more you look at it and peel back the layers, skills is not what's missing.
Exactly.
Or it's not as big a part of what is missing as is made out.
Mm. Because when you look at the numbers for just developers overall, it paints a slightly different picture. For example, GitHub, which is the go-to platform for programmers and developers, and while that doesn't necessarily indicate any trends within other tech areas like networking or security, looking at GitHub, GitHub added 10 million new developers in 2019 and saw an increase of 44% in the number of devs creating their first GitHub repositories compared to the previous year. What that means is that there are large numbers of new developers, you know, entering the industry and starting development. And, you know, let's not forget GitHub already has a very, very sizable user base and a very sizable community. And there are developers out there. It's not a skills problem. It's not a skills gap. It's a people gap, fundamentally.
So what's the answer then? What happens now?
I think part of the solution is for companies and the business community at large to take a step back and really look at its processes for technical hiring and technical recruitment. Think about realistic expectations for experience. Think about realistically what certifications and qualifications you need your technical staff and technical applicants to possess before they get to the interview stage. You know, can you maybe train them up on some of those skills without them having to have the certification first? Look at how you conduct interviews. Is it conducive to getting the kind of applicants that you need? In short, HR departments and recruiters need to really rethink how they approach technical recruitment.
Yeah, and let's also not forget, fair pay for fair work as well. We don't want the tech industry turning into the creative arts. It's like, yeah, you do it for exposure. Yeah. Oh, yeah, let me just go and pay my rent with some exposure. You get arrested for that kind of thing.
Well, on that note, that is all we've got time for this week. If you have any thoughts on what we've discussed, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at ITPro, as well as on Facebook and LinkedIn, or you can drop us an email at podcast@itpro.co.uk.
You can find more about everything we've spoken about in the show notes and even more on our website, www.itpro.co.uk.
If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the IT Pro podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, leave us a rating and a review.
We'll be back next week with more insight from the world of IT. But until then, goodbye.
Bye.
The IT Pro podcast is brought to you by the Dennis Podcast Network.